Morning. I just got back from a very warm place. So my body is contracting. most of you know the story. Maybe you don't. Half of you know the story. About the blind men and the elephant. There were four blind men, and one blind man came up to the front of the elephant, and he felt its trunk. He said, "Oh, a hose." And another blind man went to the corner of the elephant, and he felt one of its large legs, and he said, "Oh, a pillar for a house." Another blind man went to the side of the elephant and felt its side and said, "Oh, this is a sturdy wall." The fourth blind man went to the back of the elephant and felt its tail. And he said, "Oh, this is a broom." And the blind men started talking and arguing and fighting. And they beat each other up to a pulp. The blind men and the elephant. So I don't know if Bill Woywood is here today. Bill, are you here? Guess he's not. So Bill Woywood just got back from Israel, where he was for, he was there visiting as a tourist. And he said, since we can Skype for free these days, I Skyped with him while he was there. And he said, it seems to be getting more hopeless every year. Seems to be getting more hopeless every year. So, just like us, the Arabs watch their news and see different stories. The Israelis watch their news and see different stories. And the more information we have, paradoxically, generally, the more justified we feel in our point of view. Very interesting, isn't it? So things get worse and worse as we learn more and more. And this is in contrast to the core truth, which I think is at the center of spiritual being, of all being, that there's a calmness, that there's a joy beyond the thinking mind that we can all open up to. We can all open up to that. We can. We can. We could call that the whole elephant if you want to. Why not? Call it the whole elephant. Problem is that we concentrate on the things we know and fail to take into consideration how much we don't know. Based on the power about what we say to ourselves over and over about our experience. We say to ourselves over and over by watching MSNBC or Fox News or whoever our guy is, or our station is, or Amy Goodman, you know. We say to ourselves over and over the same thing, simplifying, narrating, and categorizing, instead of imagining the impossible, the whole elephant, the impossible, that we can actually know the whole elephant with its steadiness, with its calmness, with its well, that's enough, isn't it? Steadiness and calmness. Steadiness, so steady that regardless of what happens, you're just here with it. You're just here with it. So the Puritans and the Native Americans started off on good terms, right? They didn't know anything about each other. They thought, oh, they're kind of cool. And how long did it take? How long did it take before the Puritans began to realize, learn about these bizarre behaviors that these Native Americans did, their bizarre beliefs. How long did it take? Pretty much racial genocide. Pretty much. So there's a guy named Nassim Taleb, Taleb maybe, T-A-L-E-B, Nassim Taleb. Some of you have read about him, I'm sure. He talks about this kind of thing. He talks about how to learn from the turkey, So in August, the turkeys, what happened to them? They're fed every day, lots of good food, by a nice person who takes care of them. Well, what kind of a narrative would you develop? And then what happens? What happens after 1,000 days? After 1,000 days, a change takes place that they're totally unprepared for. That's life, you guys. That's life. It doesn't always have to go that way. Sometimes it goes the other way. That's life. So, here's some notes on the Titanic. The Titanic used some of the most advanced technology available at the time. Touted as the safest ship ever built, so safe that she carried only 20 lifeboats, enough to provide accommodation for only half her 2,200 passengers and crew. Since the ship's construction made her unsinkable, her lifeboats were only necessary to rescue survivors of other sinking ships. Equipped with Marconi's new wireless telegraph system and two Marconi operators kept the wireless room humming 24 hours a day. And then the captain they selected, the best captain in the Northern Hemisphere, who said prior to going out to sea, On this venture, in all my experience, I have never been in any accident. Hey, he's never been in any accident. Don't you want a captain like that? I have seen only one vessel in distress and never seen or been party to any situation which could end in disaster of any kind. He said that in 1907, and the Titanic sank in 1910. And the prior company that did it, built the Titanic, said it had 12 risk managers who had used the model of the past to tabulate that this was as safe an investment as a human being could make. And then what happened after the Titanic crashed? The narrative fallacy was completely revised. To say, oh, they never should have built that ship. There are all kinds of flaws in that. That captain was a drunkard. If you read that after, the narration's completely changed. Very interesting what we do, isn't it? Very interesting. We develop a narrative that makes us feel better because it seems like something yucky was bound to happen. And we have fundamentalist Hinduism and Buddhism with karma. Karma was bound to happen. I got hit by a car on my bike last year, coming out of the alley by Calvin Square. And I went down on the ground. And I'm an old man. I had my helmet on. I got hit. Well, so if I was a good fundamentalist Hindu or Buddhist, I'd be then thinking, well, what did I do? What did I do to cause that? I would be trying to piece together the narrative that caused that, the karmic narrative. I did this, and before I did that, If I can't find the karmic narrative, then I go back to my past life, and I try to meditate and find the karmic narrative. So we want this narrative. We cling to this narrative. And then we suffer and we fight with ourselves and with other people. We just do it. So, Yogacara Buddhism, which Ben has a new book coming out on, talks about how we get ourselves in this mess. how we get ourselves in this kind of being caught by these stories about the past and projecting them into the future. And it's very simple. We have experience. That experience gives off a perfume. And that perfume coagulates into a seed. And that seed then is a lens through which we have our next experience. So if Martin Bouchot was very kind to me just before I went out of the country, and I don't know, did something really sweet. He does a really sweet thing sometimes, you guys. Well, I'm sure you all do really sweet things. Right? Then that would have given off a positive perfume, an aroma for me. So that when I come back to Zen Center, he's the one I want to see. And because I have that seed. Oh, he's nice to me. He thinks I'm not doddering yet. He wants me to stick around. So I like those seeds. I want those seeds, right? So Yogacara says that our lives are made up of a waterfall of experience, perfume, seed, experience, perfume, seed, experience, perfume, seed, so that we don't have freedom. We don't just enjoy being here just as it is, because we're caught. We're caught. That's how we develop and maintain our narrative about the future and our understanding of the world, according to Yogacara Buddhism. So after this talk, if you stay around for coffee, you'll probably be approaching the people you have good seeds with. I don't think you're going to hang out with the ones who gave you stinky perfume last time you hung out with them. I think you'll be gravitating to the good seed people, right? So just be aware of that. Just notice that. Nothing to get wigged out about or be judgmental about, because that just creates more perfume and more seeds. So just notice it. Just notice it. So what do we do if we realize that our storyline is fallacy? What do? We don't try to avoid telling stories about our experience and predict. We're predicting beings. We like to predict. It's important to predict. We just only need to realize they're just stories and begin to embrace the unknown, the unknowable. In Greek medicine, the unknown played a really important role. The positive accident was the central method of discovery. Louis Pasteur, remember Louis Pasteur? I don't know if you guys studied him in school, but I did when I was a kid. The French chemist and microbiologist. He's responsible for vaccination and pasteurized milk. Now, pasteurized milk is not as popular as it used to be. But in those days, it was very important because people were getting ill. So Louis Pasteur said, in research, don't look for a particular result. Just realize that chance favors the prepared. Chance favors the prepared. Mm-hmm. So, Darla, would you move the clock out there? Thanks. So, our practice, our meditation practice, is partly about developing comfort with the unknown, which is necessary if we're going to fall into the deep peace, the deep calmness of just the elephant. Just the elephant. The whole elephant. So Suzuki Roshi, my teacher, said, enlightenment is an accident. Practice makes us accident prone. Right? Enlightenment is an accident. Practice makes us accident prone. He and Louis Pasteur must have hung out together in one lifetime or another, if you believe in that stuff, which I don't. But I might tomorrow. Who knows? What can we say about the whole elephant? What can we say about this core spiritual reality? A little bit. We can say a little bit tentatively. We can say, first, there's an omnipresent reality which contains all and everything. Every atom in the universe, every movement of my eyelid is the entire universe itself. Second, the universe, as it is the manifestation of this unknown essence, if you want to call it an essence. And this essence pervades everything and is beyond all our words and divisions. But it includes our words and divisions. It's just beyond the limitations of them, that's all. It doesn't leave anything out. And third, everything is temporary. Everything is changing. Everything is transient within this ultimate reality. All there is continual change. Our narratives are trying to keep up, trying to grab it. And it's always fluid, flowing. It's always moving. But still, it's good to have a narrative. Fun to have a narrative. Important to have a narrative. So the analogy that I use, which comes out of a lot of Buddhist texts, is, as I talked about it a lot during the week session, is the analogy of ocean and waves. Ocean and waves. Each of those waves is the entire ocean. And each current is the entire ocean. And yet it's just the wave it is. It's just as it is. So sometimes the surf's up, and we gotta stay with it, or we'll forget it's the whole ocean because it's body surf. We don't use a board in Zen meditation. In other times of meditation, you board. We have no board. We just body surf. Till we realize that's the whole ocean, just this, whatever it is, it's the whole ocean. So then we have, in civilization, we have exoteric spirituality. Exoteric spirituality. I'm using Houston Smith's words here, if you guys know Houston Smith. Exoteric. Different from core spirituality, exoteric spirituality, every religion, including Buddhism, has its own ways to establish and nurture distinctive philosophical, theological, historical, and even sentimental values, which they claim point to the core, which is cool till they start doing the blind man thing. And we start doing that blind man thing pretty fast, don't we, as human beings? Pretty fast. So the limitation is that exoteric religion is exclusionary by nature. Now that's not bad. That's not bad. It's just something to be careful of. Pay attention to. Because we have lots of different cultures. We should be able to enjoy all our different cultures, all our different religions, as part of a wonderful mosaic. Shouldn't we? They complement one another. The colors vibrate together. So we should enjoy each one, and you can see all the others if we really are with it. Because it's the whole elephant. So there are the more similar the practice is and the belief is, the closer it is to the core. So here's my little hierarchy for today. At the core, or very close to the core, is some form of meditation. Some form of meditation. I think it's universal. Now, somebody can probably find an exception, but I think it's universal. Some sort of meditation. And together, ethical behavior. I don't think you'll find any of the spiritual traditions that don't emphasize ethical behavior. Because after all, if each of us is a wave in this big ocean, We want to take care of the whole ocean, don't we? So ethical behavior, even if we don't realize the wave is the ocean, someone reminds us, oh, you know, you're the ocean. Oh, I should take care of myself a little bit, right? Yeah. A lot I should take care of myself, because then the rest of the ocean is going to take care of me. Pretty simple principle. Pretty simple. So meditation, that's why here at Zen Center, about 10 years ago, I introduced doing half of our retreats and half of our meditations being contemporary. And I just used the term, I just made up the term contemporary. I thought, why not make it contemporary? Because I thought, this is the core. This is the core. We don't have to fight about this one. This is universal. Now, I'm sure you're going to find a religion, some spiritual discipline excludes that, but that's okay. I had a teacher in college who said, oh, that's the exception that proves the rule. So, meditation, zazen, and ethical behavior. The second rung down, chanting. Not all of these practices have chanting, but many, many of them do. Most of them do have some kind of chanting. I remember first hearing the Gregorian chants when I was a young man, when I was into this stuff. I thought, wow, there's something going on there. There's something. My heart's opening up to something. I don't know what it is. I'm a Unitarian, but wow. You know what I mean? Wow. I don't want to be a Unitarian anymore. I didn't do any cool chanting like that, right? So then I went actually to stay at the new Kamaldoli Hermitage in Big Sur, California, but that's a whole other talk. That's before I got into Zen. I didn't know. You don't know. We don't know anything. We just make ourselves accident prone by doing this practice over and over and over again. And see what happens. See what happens. So the second most common one is chanting. Of course, not about, you can't say my chanting is better than his chanting, because I got the Bodhisattva chanting and they got the fundamentalist Jesus chanting. Well, maybe my Bodhisattva is just as fundamentalist. As soon as I say someone else is fundamentalist, who's the fundamentalist in the room? Yeah, who's the fundamentalist in the room? So, meditation, chanting, third down, bowing. In contemporary, we don't bow here. Now, a lot of you guys come here bow anyway on Sunday. That's fine, bow all you want, but I'm not going to mandate it. It's present maybe in two-thirds of these traditions. I made that up, maybe 70%. It's not present in Taoism. And Taoism is Zen as much Taoism as it is Buddhist. Not present in the Native American spirituality that I practiced. But it's cool. Do it. It's cool. The fourth one, the one that's the most exoteric and the least common, are those forms of practice of being there purely cultural. Now, of course, the people who do them say, oh, no, they help us open. I'm sure they help us open. They help us open. The Oryoki, our nested eating bowls, really help us open, because we do everything precisely and calmly, folding our napkin, eating our food. Beautiful ritual. But nobody else does it. So it belongs to the fourth level. As do robes, as does this thing that I'm wearing called the Raksu. This beautifully sewn Raksu that I didn't sew myself, or it would not be beautiful. Somebody sewed it for me. I won't even say who, because I don't remember. Somebody. So, we want to make ourselves accident prone if we're serious about our meditation, so that we can break through this narrative fallacy. So what do? Imagine the impossible. Numero uno, imagine the impossible. Really? Really? I was foolish as a young man to imagine the impossible. When my teacher said, I could tap into a stillness and serenity, and he did not use the term tap into, because he was Japanese, but that's how I translate it. I could tap into a stillness, a serenity, a peace that was beyond my understanding. I believed him, even though my mind was just higgledy-piggledy, to and fro, backwards and forwards, upside down and inside down. I believed him. I imagined the impossible. That's not the belief we fight about. It's imagining that you can go beyond the limitations of your narrative, what you're saying to yourself. To just be here and see this wonderful huge elephant and enjoy it, him, her, we, she. Take care of it. As best you can. And the second thing is that we can try to be ethical in our behavior. We can try to reach out and create good seeds when we have bad seeds, a bad feeling. People have given us bad perfume. We don't want to hang out with them at coffee anymore. Well, maybe you should hang out with that person at coffee. And you should just try to go freshly with them, to them. Engage them freshly. My wife and I have gone for 13 years to this place in the Caribbean. And we just got back last night, actually, at midnight. Yeah, midnight. My goal was to get to sleep by midnight so I could get up and give my talk. I made it. What am I saying? Oh, yeah, so my wife... So this place we've gone to for 13 years, when my wife goes into the stores, this is a little place in the Caribbean, people are really surly to her. They are indifferent. Do you have brooms? Yeah, we got brooms. Where are the brooms? Oh, somewhere. Go find them. They're like that with Linda. She climbs. Well, they're like that with me, too, so it's not her. So this last trip, the 13th trip, she said, I am going to go into all these stores and I'm going to just be really nice to people. I'm going to just assume they've had a bad day and chat them up and ask them about their families. Well, it worked. So we had friends with us last week and she said, boy, people are a lot more friendly here than I realized they were. So she doesn't know. She's not a Buddhist. You don't have to be a Buddhist to do this. Just have to make your effort. Make your effort. You know, she chats them up about their family. They open up. They help her find a special broom that is only for, you know, because they're human. We're all human. There aren't too many people that if you don't really approach them and really engage with them, give off good perfume. There are a few people. There are a few people who won't. But most people do. Most people do. So, imagining ethical behavior, doing practices that have the most similarities, which really is meditation. If you do those three things, see what happens. Just keep doing them and see what happens. Keep doing them and keep doing them and keep doing them. Through imagining, through ethical behavior, and through sitting, we can stop living our lives just based on seeds created from this perfume of the past. We can do that. We just fall into that. It's an accident. We just fall into it. And I've been, since I'm an old guy and I've been practicing for many years, I've been fortunate to do the core practices and actually several different religions besides Buddhism during my life. I'll just talk just a little bit about that right now, a little bit. So I started as a Zen student in San Francisco, but at the same time, when I was a Zen student in San Francisco, I went every week to the Vedanta Temple in San Francisco, the Advaita, non-dualistic Vedanta Temple. And I went there every week, at least once a week. The reason I chose Zen was that there was a teacher there I could sit with every day, and they had sitting every day. In the Vedanta temple, they didn't have sitting every day. They had these swamis, but they didn't seem that approachable. And then I heard that you were supposed to be celibate, and I thought, well, that takes care of that. That takes care of that. But here's one of the first things I read. I don't know if chronologically it's the first thing, but one of the first things I read when I went to the Vedanta temple. Let's see if I have it with me. Oh, I do. Which this is something you've got. If you've read Advaita Vedanta, you know you've heard this story. So Advaita Vedanta came 200-300 years. This is from the Chung. I can't remember one of the Upanishads, which is 200-300 years before Buddhism, 200-300 years before Taoism, before Christianity, before the Old Testament, before Judaism. So here's one of my favorite stories. It's father and son. Father and son. Son, did you ask your teacher for the spiritual knowledge that enables you to hear the unheard, think the unthought, and know the unknown? What's that knowledge, Father? Just as by knowing a lump of clay, everything that is made of clay can be known, since any differences are only words and the essential reality is clay. In the same way, by knowing a piece of gold, all that is made of gold can be known, since any differences are only words, and the reality is only gold. Father, please teach me this knowledge. So the father told his son to bring him a fruit from a nearby banyan tree and to break it open. The son did and said, oh, there are seeds inside, all very small. The father said, now break one of the seeds and tell me what you see. Nothing, father. My son, this great banyan tree has grown from a seed so small that you cannot see it. Believe me, an invisible and subtle essence is the whole universe. Now take this salt and put it in some water and bring it to me tomorrow morning. The next morning, son looked for the salt but couldn't find it because it had dissolved. The father asked his son to taste the water. Salty, he said. And the father said, the salt will always remain in the water. That's right. The salt permeates the water, just like the self. Even though we cannot see it, the self is within all things, and there is nothing that does not come from it. This invisible and subtle essence is the spirit of the whole universe. That is reality. That is truth. And you, son, you are that. 8th century before the contemporary era. Right? Yeah, onto something, right? Onto something. Which we can all get onto. We can all do this. It's for all of us. So after I went to the Vedanta temple, then I came back and I did more Zen practice for a long time. And then about, I don't know, the late 80s or the early 90s, I started doing some Lakota practice. Lakota? Native American Lakota? And I kept my sitting going, but I did Lakota practice. And we worked with a pipe. I had a pipe. It's too much time to go into that. But I worked with a pipe. And the pipe. The pipe is like the Roksu. It's where you have it with you at all times. And it symbolizes, just as the Roksu does, symbolizes all life. The pipe, the bowl of the pipe is circular. It's circular. All life is within it. All life is within the bowl of the pipe. And then you put the pieces of tobacco in the pipe. Those are all beings. All beings are in the pipe. Then you smoke the pipe. You smoke all beings up. You give yourself to all beings. You appreciate all beings. Every little being in the pipe, you appreciate it. And you don't smoke the pipe until you've held the pipe for a long time. When Paul and I went up to do our thing. Was that 4 days and four nights, Paul?
Five
days. Paul and I did 5 days and five nights without food or water. We did that. People say, no, you couldn't have done that. But we did, didn't we?
Yeah.
5 days and five nights. We were up on the hill at our running house in Rosebud by ourselves with no clothes on. Oh, we had a buffalo. I guess we had underpants on, right? We have underpants on? And we had a buffalo hide. It was just a blanket over us. And we kept the pipe. Elmer said to me, keep the pipe. He said, all beings are here. Keep the pipe with you. When you sleep, sleep on your back and keep the pipe on your, with you. On your, so don't spill any of those beings out of the pipe. So this is all just metaphorical, but also it's a practice. All life is included in the pipe. So I had that practice. And then before I came back to Zen Center, I worked with for some time with a bhakti teacher. That's devotional. Devotional. It's Advaita Vedanta too, but it's devotional. Amici. And that was wonderful. And then I came back to Zen Center and started practicing again. And probably my second or third year, I taught a course in Taoism. Because I said, how Buddhists aren't realizing how much Taoism, Zen is, how much Zen is Taoism. The only thing I haven't practiced, well, I didn't practice Sufi stuff. I think that's really cool. I'm sure there's lots of stuff I didn't practice. Why didn't I practice Christianity? Well, I'm an old guy. But prior to the 1990s, centering prayer wasn't even around. So there wasn't any. I read Meister Eckhart. I read St. John of the Cross. I read Teresa de Avila. But there wasn't any practice. Wasn't any practice. So the key to success in our spiritual practice is willingness to fail. It's putting ourselves on the cushion. Putting ourselves on the cushion. Putting ourselves on the cushion. Trial and error. Trial and error. It's always an error until the accident happens. So Apelles, the Roman artist, is known for two things. One, practicing every day. He practices artistry every day. And achieving by accident. Here's an example. One day, Apelles was so exasperated in trying to depict the foam on the dog's mouth. I don't know what that is. I guess he was painting a dog. foaming mouth dog. Repeatedly repainting the scene and wiping it clean, he was so frustrated that he threw his sponge at the picture in frustration. It struck the dog's mouth, achieving by accident what the artist could not by design. Dogen, our teacher, Dogen. A Zen master's life is one mistake after another. He doesn't say a Zen student's life. He says a Zen master's life is one mistake after another. We keep creating circumstances where accidents can happen. So when people come in to see me and say my Zazen's not going well, that's fine. As long as you're continuing to try to bring your mind into focus, to come back and get your butt down on the cushion. Get your butt down on the cushion. Get your butt down on the cushion. So here's a little story about Colonel Sanders. One of my gurus, right? I've never been into a Kentucky Fried Chicken place myself, but maybe there's always a first. Colonel Sanders was a fellow who really loved to share his fried chicken recipe. He had a lot of positive influence from those who tasted the chicken. Now, the colonel was retired and up in age, and while most people believed in the sanctimony of retirement, the colonel opted to sell the world on his cool new chicken recipe. With little in terms of means at his disposal, Colonel Sanders traveled door to door to houses and restaurants all over the local area. He wanted to partner with someone to help promote his chicken recipe. Needless to say, he was met with little enthusiasm. He started traveling by car to different restaurants and cooked his fried chicken on the spot for restaurant owners. If the owner liked the chicken, they would enter into a handshake agreement to sell the colonel's chicken. Legend has it that the Colonel Sanders heard 1,009 no's before he heard his first yes. Okay? 1,009 no's. 1,009 times your mind will wander out of control while you're sitting. Don't worry about it. Just do it. Don't worry about it. It's the nature of the mind to wander. Wait for the 1,010th time. It'll come. But don't count. It'll never come then because you're not making yourself accident prone. You're stuck on a narrative. Tim's narrative. Well, don't believe my narrative, you guys. Please. So instead, let's follow Einstein. Instead of being embarrassed because our practice is no good or our mind is all over the place, we're ashamed, we're discouraged, let's follow Einstein's. You need to love to lose. That's what Einstein said. You need to love to lose. So instead of clinging to our storyline about how things will be based on what happened in the past, we put ourselves in situations where favorable outcomes are much larger. It's much more likely a favorable outcome will happen than an unfavorable. That's true with daily meditation. It's much more likely there will be a favorable outcome. And retreats, even retreats, especially retreats. Even though the first day of retreat you may think, oh, and the second day of retreat you may think, and the third day of the retreat you may run away, if you stick with it, you can open up to the whole elephant. It just happens. It just happens when you get out of the way, when your narration gets out of the way. By steeping ourselves in silence, we become silence. And I know often when you do your zazen, you feel like you're steeping yourself in noise. But actually, it's externally silent. You are steeping yourself in silence, and at some point, you become it. You become what you already are. That's all. So, I think that's basically what I want to say today. And I see there's a little bit of time for questions or comments. So, I will entertain them. Yeah. Who?
Steve.
Sure.
This is, I always, you know, there's always this thing about, ideology.
Yeah.
Religious wars is ideologically driven. I've always seen it as more materially driven.
More maternally driven, materially driven.
So, like the Shiites and the Sunnis it's really about resources. Or even reputational resources.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It's not really about doctrine.
Mm. Mm.
So, I think that's how I've always found that as kind of a cop out on the left. Like, kind of a censure of religion as, all these doctrines drive wars. Well, as a matter of fact, I don't think that's really the case.
Well, that may be true. The point is, though, that narratives, it doesn't matter if it's a political narrative, a religious narrative, a narrative that you and I have about how warm the day is. if we're caught by our narratives, we can't really commune with each other. We can't really, really enjoy each other's company in a deep way. Your point is good, but it's a little bit different than my point.
Yeah.
Who else? What else?
I comment. What your thoughts stimulated in me was this idea that there's all this common ground, and yet we still put a lot of energy into being attached to our story that differentiates us somehow. And I can see that, being separate or joining is sort of a tension that we have to kind of wrestle with. But it does seem like joining is way more fragile than differentiating. Like it's not a level playing field.
Not a level playing field. Will you explain what you mean?
In the sense that, it takes two people to agree on common principles and really join
in a
meaningful way. one person can look at the whole and just make an independent, autonomous choice that it's bullshit.
That's right.
And so it's way easier to be a differentiator than a joiner. So, I think it's amazing that we get any joining. Just in some ways, the easier route is to just sort of say, well, I don't want to buy into that, and not even try to understand.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Who else? Got a little time still. Yeah.
You spoke briefly about the not knowing helping us, being comfortable with the not knowing.
Yes.
Could you speak a little about what to do if the not knowing becomes too abundant or troublesome?
So, could everybody hear what he said? It's a good question, isn't it? It's a good question. For one thing, we're human beings, and we need some solace. We need some solace. We need some sense of being able to feel like our narrative is worth something. And so I would say, I would say reversing what I said before, well, not reversing it, that developing a healthy narrative, like my wife did, I'm going to really try to reach out to these people. I don't know what is going on with them. I don't know. But I'm not, this makes me too uncomfortable to be with them when they're just saying, oh, I got a broom someplace. So I am going to make an effort to reach out to them. And when we do that, that's the ethical component of this. Usually it grounds us. Usually it grounds us. And when we're grounded, then we're ready to move back into the unknown. Because really, everything about the future is unknown. Everything is unknown. But we do need the grounding in a kind narrative and kind story. I mean, Linda said to herself and said to me, I think that if I'm kind to these people and ask about their families, something might happen. And it did. It did. But she needed that because she was just flummoxed by this. Right. So that's important. That's important. Does that make sense?
Yeah, some. You know.
Some. Okay, well, continue if it doesn't make, if you'd like to probe a little.
I guess what I'm taking from it is that there's a balance to be struck.
There is a balance. We need narrative. We need story. Story is wonderful. Narrative is wonderful. We need it. And people who say, oh, I can just be in the now, let go of all that narrative. Well, it's how we relate to each other. A language is a convention that we've developed to be together as a tribe, as this American tribe, this heterogeneous American tribe, this language. Let's take care of it. Let's honor it. It's part of the elephant. It's part of the elephant. Sure. David. Hi, David.
How are you?
Good.
Going back to your three points of religion, and it might relate to your question, which I thought was excellent. It was around meditation. It was the three core elements of meditation. The other was ethics, and the other was imagination.
Imagining the impossible.
Right. It doesn't community. Isn't that also a core? We
could say that. We could. I mean, I actually just made these three up.
So. Okay. I
wasn't quoting the great teacher so and so.
Okay.
but let's think about it. Imagining the impossible. Demonstrating ethical behavior. And meditation. Well, meditation requires community to do it well. I did meditate for a couple of years in northern Minnesota on my own, but my mind was all over the place. and my discipline was no good. I needed community. I needed community. And ethical behavior also is all about community, isn't it? It's about, well, this is my family, my daughter, my son, my neighbor, you know, my first cousin, people who live in North Minneapolis, you know, going, you know how we do loving kindness meditation, we extend to everybody. So community, of course, is vitally important. Vitally important. We are community. We are already, even if we're fighting, even if those four blind men are fighting, they're community. They just don't know. They just forgot. Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you. Pamela.
Is there a compassion component or a foundation to all of this?
Well, hopefully the ethical component is not dry. It's not based on, oh, I should be good. I should be nice to Pamela because, da-da-da, Tim said it's one of the three or something. Hopefully it comes from my heart because I read this literature, I hear people talk about how we're undivided. With my heart, I want to reach out to you. Even if you're a little scary, I still want to reach out to you. Even if you're foreign, you know, you're rough with me here. You know, I want to reach out because I'm practicing this non-dividedness from all life, ethically. Not just as a rule, but as my core, trying to manifest my core. Very important. Compassion is very important. Ethics without compassion is what? Just dry leaves. Yeah.
Do we still have time?
It's 8:02, so I guess we have 2 minutes and 33 seconds.
So I had the opportunity to go to a trauma healing workshop earlier this week, and its focus was on healing trauma. It was based on some community groups that have been meeting for several years in the African-American community to tell each other their stories and to help each other heal. And so people from that practice group came and talked to the rest of us. And the focus of this was on healing the trauma of being white. After that group delivered their message, we broke up into small groups. And uh-huh. We were supposed to be talking about what whiteness has done to me. So there was a group of six of us. Two people shared, I would say, trauma stories with a capital T. And then there were a couple of other folks who spoke. And then finally, there was a young man, and he led off by saying, well, I don't want to criticize what you two people, just said, but I think that when white people focus on their pain and neglect the pain of the African-American community, that's an example of racism and white fragility. At that point, the group kind of exploded. The women who were criticized were very angry. There was a back and forth. And we just could not find a way to move that conversation forward. I guess what this brought home to me was that I'm hoping there are practical skills that one can learn to employ them in situations, because these kinds of disagreements are exactly the problem we need to be able to move beyond. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all.